ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australia's always been the lucky country. Sunshine, beaches, and that one magpie that always seems to know where you live.
Yeah, get away from my chip, please. Luck might not cut it anymore.
So can we make our own luck and turn this complicated world to our advantage?
That's our global roaming summer season. Can Australia surf the world's chaos without wiping out?
Fresh new episodes all summer. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor and this is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Today, I'm taking a look back at some of your favourite stories from 2025 and revisiting those all-important firsts at work. Maybe you're in the car right now, dropping off a teenager or grandkid at a summer job, or maybe the young person in your life has just finished school or uni and they're stepping into their first real job. Coming up, how the social class you're born into can shape your entire working life and what it takes to break that mould. And later, are internships really under threat from AI, or is it all just hype? But first, I want to ask you if you remember your first job, because how can you not? It's like stepping over the threshold of adulthood, and that first paycheck simultaneously feels like so much and so little. My first job was for a small family business, but it wasn't until years later that I realised I had been paid way below the award wage for the time that I'd worked there. Once my colleague and I, both quivering teenagers, asked our boss if we'd get paid extra because we were working on a public holiday, and he just waved his hand and said, we don't do that here. But that was decades ago. Surely things are better now, right? Well, a study shows that more than one in three young people have been ripped off by their employers, and they're also unlikely to challenge their bosses about it. In a second, you'll hear from the researcher who led this study, but first, someone who actually was a victim of workplace exploitation. Olivia is 17. She's a student and casual worker who says she was fired after questioning underpayment at her first job. Olivia, what happened?
I got my first job when I was nearly 16 at the, nearly 15, 14 and 9 months was when I got my first job. And it was at a smaller fast food chain, and it was a big enough of a company that my parents thought it would be a good place to apply, but they ended up firing me because I spoke up about being underpaid through my paychecks with no reason why and no explanation.
So how long were you working there before you realised that you were being underpaid?
Maybe 6 months. Before I realised.
Was it like they were paying you a lesser hourly rate or they weren't paying you penalties? Like, what was the nature of the underpayment?
They were underpaying me certain shifts they wouldn't pay for, or they would underpay for less hours because I was on the lowest rate anyway, being at such a young age, and I wouldn't work Saturdays or anything. When we counted up what I should have been paid due to my clocked hours, it was a lot like lower than the amount I was getting paid, and I was only getting paid fortnightly, so it didn't seem like the number was too low, but when I added up what I should have been getting with my dad, it was lower.
Yeah, right. So 6 months in, you realise that you've been underpaid, you call them out. What was the response?
They just couldn't get back to me. I called my manager, I called HR, I got my mum to contact them and they wouldn't respond. So then my mum told me to go into work when my manager was working and she wanted to come in as well, but I didn't want to be embarrassed, so I went in by myself and he said he would contact me tomorrow. And then tomorrow I got a email that I was fired and I hadn't done anything to be fired.
Oh my gosh. So you reckon you were let go for speaking up? Like, did they tell you why?
It was because they were over the budget for some reason or something. But we were already short-staffed. They have a high turnover rate. because I think they hire very young people and then they don't pay them for, if you pick up a shift, you don't get paid. And when you have to close the store, at the actual closing hour where customers aren't allowed in is when we stop being paid, but we never got paid for the extra hour it would take to clean everything and put everything away. But our shifts would be rostered on until that extra hour that we wouldn't be paid for.
Did you talk to your colleagues about this at all? Did other people say that similar things had happened to them?
Yeah, everyone that I worked with stopped working there in less than a year. Wow. But they still have staff that just change all the time.
Yeah, that's your very first job experience. Like, how has that left you feeling?
Honestly, it's actually left me with a bit of anxiety when I'm trying to do well at jobs I've had since then. I've only had two jobs since then. I had a Christmas casual in retail, and now I have my job at a smaller business. And being at a small business that I know well and I trust has been really, really good for me, because I feel like I'm part of their family and I know that nothing, I'm aware of everything that's going on, including my pay, which has been really nice. But it's also left me feeling like I need to be aware of that, and like I need to be constantly checking my pay because of my first experience, which I feel is something that you wouldn't normally have if you didn't have a really first bad experience with being paid.
I'm sure that you've told all your mates about this. Like, what advice are you giving to your friends?
I honestly think if you are getting a part-time job, you should be like very aware of your pay, even though you're just a teenager. And I think that you should be consulting it with your parents as well, because they are more experienced in being paid. But I honestly think it's poor, because it happens a lot of the time, and it's just kids that are unaware of the workforce, and that's what they're taking advantage of.
Olivia, thank you so much for sharing your story. Olivia is a 17-year-old student and a casual worker. You're listening to Radio National's Life Matters. I'm Tegan Taylor. We're talking about students, young people being underpaid, being exploited because they're young and perhaps don't know any better. Electo says young people are vulnerable simply because they're young and perhaps not confident about speaking up. More importantly, there's been at least 4 decades of union bashing and undermining of industrial protection systems so that young people don't think to join the union, and the capacity for unions to intervene has been greatly diminished. Exploitation of young people happens because it's been increasingly made possible to do so. To dig into the data a bit more, I've got with me Professor John Howe from the University of Melbourne's Law School, who surveyed thousands of young people aged between 15 and 30. John, thanks for coming on Life Matters.
Thanks for having me on, Tegan.
So we've just heard Olivia's story. Is it a common story to you?
Well, yes, it is. Anecdotally, I mean, I hear a lot about this from my teenage kids and from other people talking about their kids, but our survey certainly is bearing that anecdotal evidence out in the data we're finding.
So you looked at a range of industries. Were you surprised at the conditions?
Look, I was surprised. I wasn't surprised about the underpayment, because that seems to be rife throughout the labour market, but the breadth of how young workers are being ripped off was pretty staggering, ranging from, wages being $15 an hour or less for a third of the workers we surveyed, but then going on to things like not being paid for extra work done, not being paid for training that was required, having to pay for necessary equipment, uniforms and so on for work. The list goes on. So that was very surprising.
This is an issue that's been around for decades. Like, I've shared my own experience before. I think everyone has a touchstone for this. Why is it still being able to happen?
Well, I think there's a combination of reasons. One is a lack of awareness of what young people are entitled to earn. So there's a lack of awareness of workplace rights. The guest you had on mentioned, you know, not wanting to, some young people not wanting to, you know, rock the boat with their employer for fear of losing their job, which is what happened to her, of course, you know, not knowing about avenues you can go to get advice. Mm. So, you know, we did find that about half of the workers who thought they were being ripped off did seek advice from a government agency or a union or a community legal centre, but that leaves half the workers who thought they were being ripped off not getting advice outside sort of family and so on. And then you've got a lot of people who probably didn't know they were being ripped off and then they wouldn't be, you know, getting advice at all.
Kristen's called in. You had a really awful experience when you were given a trial shift. Tell me about that.
Yes, I tried to find some work during university. So I'd go to Brisbane and then I'd come back to a regional town and try to get some work. And they said, yeah, they're interested in hiring me and putting me on the bar. They just have to make sure that, you know, I'm good enough with the customers, all that kind of stuff. And I said, oh, okay. And the trial run just happened to be New Year's Eve and worked across into New Year's Day for about 6 to 8 hours, no pay. And only looking back did I think, okay, that was just to get a free shift, I feel. So, yes, that was my experience.
Did you ever end up going back for another shift?
Yeah, I did. I worked there for probably on and off in university breaks for about 2 years. And it's only just thinking back now going, okay, that was just a sneaky way to get, because I worked my butt off and I was very, you know, capable. But yeah, very interesting.
Yeah, especially a trial shift. You're so, so eager to please. Kristen, thanks so much for sharing your story. John, this unpaid trial shift thing was a theme in your research as well.
Yeah, that's right. And it's totally unlawful. If you're engaged by an employer to work and you do the work, it doesn't matter whether it's a trial or training, you have to be paid. And we found a large number of workers were, you know, not being paid for those trial shifts or training shifts. And, you know, you're right, it's something that some employers exploit because they don't, you know, they're confident the young worker's not going to complain about it because they want the job.
So not every young person has a parent that can advocate for them, but if you are a parent and you are wanting to help, what kind of questions could you be asking?
I think trying to find out what exactly your kids' workplace experience is, and there are places is the first step. But, you know, going beyond that family discussion, it's possible for inquiries to be made to the Fair Work Ombudsman, which is our national regulator for working conditions. Doesn't mean that further steps have to be taken, but I think the first step is to be fully aware of what your rights are and if you are being exploited, even if you're worried about taking further action. The Fair Work Ombudsman has a lot of useful tools to try and work out whether you are being ripped off. Unions, obviously, but often you need to be a member to be able to get that advice. And community legal centres, all the most capital cities, at least in Australia, have community legal centres which do give young people a lot of advice around workplace issues.
Professor John Howe is with the University of Melbourne's Law School. You also heard there from 17-year-old Olivia, who was underpaid at her first job and fired when she questioned it. Well, stick with me next here on Life Matters. Could the postcode you're born in impact your entire career?
Christopher Skase wasn't your typical entrepreneur.
Christopher had the most beautiful hair.
Incredibly boyish good looks.
And with his wife Pixie, they became...
the story of Australia. The billionaires, the extravagance.
The Skases had it all. Until they didn't.
They'd gone from the it couple to persona non grata.
I'm Mark Humphreys. To binge the full series now, search for ABC Rewind and look for Skase, Fall of a Tycoon on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
We don't talk much about social class in Australia. In fact, we pride ourselves on the idea of a fair go, no matter who you are or where you're from. But is that the reality? Findings from Diversity Council Australia research show that if you come from a background of social disadvantage, you're less likely to get promoted or offered career development opportunities. And yet, most leaders don't even see class as an issue in Australia. In a moment, you'll hear from someone who had to change the way he spoke to climb the career ladder. But I'd like to start by unpacking the issue with Catherine Hunter, who is CEO of Diversity Council Australia. Catherine, what have the findings shown?
Really, it's very much that class is a powerful but hidden barrier that definitely shapes people's opportunities at work. And our early data shows a persistent class ceiling that you referred to, which can limit career opportunities for workers who are marginalised by their social class. Some of the early findings show that only 44% of class marginalised workers were offered career development opportunities in the past year. And that's compared with 76% of class privileged workers. And only 22% of class marginalised workers feel valued and respected in their team. So that really brings in the human element. We're nearly half the rate of workers who are privileged by their social class do feel valued at 41%. So what this means is unless organisations acknowledge and act on class, they're really leaving talent behind.
What do we mean when we say class? Because I think if you ask almost anyone, they'll say they're middle class. Everyone thinks they're middle class.
Yeah, that's
and we don't
true.
Have aristocracy in Australia. So what do we mean in Australia when we say class?
So we actually use a self-identified scale, which is the MacArthur scale of subjective social status. And class refers to a person's social standing compared to other people in Australia. And it's very much based on factors such as their wealth, their income, education, occupation, their access to social capital, which is their connections, their networks, and also even their hobbies and leisure activities. And all of these factors combine to determine a person's status or power and their position. And so that's what we refer to as social standing or social class.
So it's not just money?
No, absolutely not. In fact, we often hear about socioeconomic status or SES, and I guess that's just a very sort of narrow way. And of course, that can change for people over time. So class and the broader sort of social and cultural aspects that we consider actually give us a much bigger and bit clearer picture that also of the systems, because it's really systems change that we're always looking to address as well.
This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking about class in Australia. Catherine Hunter is the CEO of Diversity Council Australia, who's done recent research showing that there is a class ceiling in Australia. The idea that you could be disadvantaged at work if you come from a particular background, even though we like to think of ourselves as being egalitarian. Dr. Angelo Capuano is a law lecturer with Central Queensland University and has kind of experienced this firsthand. Angelo, your entry into the legal world came with some barriers. What did that look like for you?
Good morning, Tegan. Thanks for having me. So, yeah, early on in my career, I was shocked to experience a number of barriers when trying to enter the legal profession. One example comes to mind. So I received a call after applying for a job with a law firm, and the call was to reject me from that position. But the reason provided to me was that the successful applicant had a share portfolio, which showed that they had commercial acumen. But of course, being in my early 20s, I couldn't afford a share portfolio. So that was a bit of a wake-up call to the realities of classism in the workplace.
That is wild to me, because this is obviously a very early, like, entry-level position. And that's one of the unspoken criteria, I guess.
Absolutely. And a share portfolio of wealth, as was foreshadowed earlier, is a classic proxy for class status.
So that was one example. There's been others that you encountered sort of once you did get into a law firm.
Yeah, absolutely. So I managed to successfully get a job as a seasonal clerk in a law firm. Again, this is in my early 20s. And one of our activities was to map our networks, particularly our social networks that could benefit the law firm and result with clients. Needless to say, I didn't get the job, but that was another example of what might be measuring social class in prospective employees to determine their fit.
Yeah, Catherine, that's really an example of that social capital you were speaking about before.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, Angela, I'm sorry to hear that was your experience, but look, it's sadly, it's not an uncommon one. And I think, you know, you mentioned that there's things such as unpaid internships. You know, if you can't afford to actually work for free for a period of time because you're from a class marginalised group, then it's certainly, it's another barrier for you to participating in the workforce.
Angelo, you had a similar experience. You really kind of had to change the way you spoke.
Yeah, so coming from the western suburbs of Melbourne, there's a particular accent you acquire growing up, and you become increasingly conscious of that, particularly the grammar, so the grammatical characteristics that you acquire. So, yeah, there was a need to actively work on that and try and refine that over time to avoid the negative implications of your accent.
So it's not just your own experience you're drawing on here. You also have written a book about class and social background discrimination. So it's something you're quite active in, Angelo. What would you like to see change in Australia?
Yeah, so I think from my research, my current research, and also what I've written in my book, the issues around class discrimination are being turbocharged by algorithms and AI, and increasingly becoming overt. So it's really difficult to identify instances of class discrimination. So there's situations where employers might use social media to vet applicants, cultural fit. But one issue with cultural fit is that often it aligns with a person's background, signals with a person's background. AI video interviews as well might disadvantage people from working class backgrounds based on the way they speak, their communication style, or the use of non-verbal cues. And also referring back to the covert nature of class discrimination, there's also algorithms used by employers to try and find diamonds in the rough, to try and increase representation in the workplace from people from working class backgrounds. But the issue with this is that the algorithm might seem like a good idea on paper, but it might have the opposite effect in practice. So think of it as a really bad Band-Aid. Mm-hmm. And the algorithm measures disadvantaged background, but really it relies on unreliable indicators of disadvantage, and it misses the private important ones. And the danger in this is that it can filter out the true battlers, those who experience true disadvantage. So what I'd like to see in Australia is particularly tackling the issues that arise around AI, the use of AI, and also the use of algorithms in employment, because I just want to reiterate, we're seeing class discrimination become a lot more hidden and a lot more covert.
Catherine, how does what Angelo's saying there with the algorithms and AI being part of this picture now, just to make it even more complicated, yeah, how does that play into the research that you've done?
Look, we haven't particularly looked at AI within this research, but we have done some research on some of the concerns around AI and recruitment. So I think they're reflecting a lot of the things that Angelo mentioned. So we're certainly very mindful that AI can unfortunately bake in bias, because typically it's still relying upon historical data, and we all know that there's biases in the historical data already. So there really needs to be, I think, more education around the use, the ethical and responsible use of AI, and something that the teams and organisations really need training on, so that they're aware of the dangers of AI and in terms of baking in that bias.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Catherine Hunter, who's the CEO of Diversity Council Australia, and Dr. Angelo Capuano, who's a law lecturer at Central Queensland University, about class in Australia, something that we pretend isn't a thing, but the research done by Diversity Council Australia is showing that, yes, it is. It's holding people back in the workplace. So how do we tackle it? Greg says, after working on Wall Street for 10 years, I returned to Melbourne to work on a big bank trading desk. The first question my new colleagues asked me was what private school I went to. I went to a government school and I was over 50 at the time. I faced class bias my whole working life. It's real, and one reason I moved to the US. My first experience, says someone else, in privilege playing out was applying for housing. I heard and saw some other applicants and knew that I'd be viewed as a more favourable applicant, and I was. So, Catherine, do we need to just stop pretending in Australia that we're classless?
Look, I think we do. There's certainly something in the national psyche that likes to think that we're a classless society, but it's just not the case. And, you know, at the moment, you just have to look at the fact that we're experiencing a 20-year high in wealth inequality, such that it prompted an economic reform roundtable. So it does matter. It does exist. And the first step in creating change is to actually acknowledge it and to be aware of it in workplaces, but especially to understand that it does create additional barriers for people from class marginalised backgrounds.
Angelo, you spoke before about the role of AI and algorithms in recruiting. There's also other overseas models that you've looked at. What do you think could work in Australia?
Yeah, so just drawing on what Catherine said, I think addressing the egalitarian myth in Australia is really important to just identify that, yes, we do have a class-based society, we do have class barriers, and we do have social inequality. I mean, we see it every day walking through Melbourne, people experiencing homelessness. We have a broken childcare system. We have a huge divide between public and private schools. So, yeah, definitely class barriers exist. So I think that's the first hurdle. But we can learn a lot from the UK, and I think the UK's leading the charge in this area, given that it's had historically quite a defined class structure. So you got aristocracy, the royal family, it's a clearly defined class structure. Whereas in Australia, people might think that, no, we don't have a class structure, but we do. And the reality is it's a lot more fluid. So what I'd like to see is us borrowing a lot of ideas from the UK, particularly around borrowing an organisation similar to the Social Mobility Commission, which can help in researching the problem, particularly from an Australian perspective, but not as just a problem, researching solutions to the problem, how we can implement social policy which is tailored for Australia. And that can hopefully lead to other benefits like changed culture and policy within employers.
So, Catherine, how could employers do this? What would you like to see here?
I think the very first step, as I mentioned, is to be class aware. We're seeing some great examples, actually. And Angelo, I'm sure you're across some of the efforts within the legal profession to really look at Ashurst has developed a social mobility and inclusion network. And that really is an opportunity to look at sponsoring and mentoring people from class marginalised backgrounds. So by being aware and understanding the barriers, we're starting to see leaders in some professions really step up and start to actively look at initiatives that will try and remove those barriers by at least being aware of them in the first place. And that active sponsorship and mentorship is something that people can do. And of course, collecting data so that people actually understand the full extent of the challenge within their workplace as well.
Catherine, Angelo, thank you both so much for joining me today. Catherine Hunter is CEO of Diversity Council Australia. You also heard from Dr. Angelo Capuano, a law lecturer at Central Queensland University who faced social class barriers early in his career. Well, coming up, you'll hear how AI is going to help us at work. But could it make things harder for young workers trying to secure their first jobs?
She was every student's favourite teacher.
She would joke around with us, more like a friend than a teacher.
And I remember her saying to me that this is not goodbye, this is see you later kind of thing.
Well, if Ali is able to open up to somebody, that's a good thing.
But what began as a tension became something else.
She was brainwashing us from the start.
The Favourite, a five-part investigation into the cost of silence. Available now. Search Background Briefing on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
What were some of the tasks you had to do in your first real-life adult job? Me, as a baby journalist, I was writing pretty short, simple stories about cake decorating competition winners and army cadet camps. My photographer friends were taking photos of products that would go in catalogues. My mates in marketing were writing copy for brochures. It was pretty menial work, stuff that our bosses would never have done, but it was work that had to get done. And it helped us learn the basics of our job so that when we got to the more important stuff, we were ready for the responsibility. Well, a top LinkedIn executive has written an opinion piece saying that AI can now do entry-level tasks, so there's no longer any need to take on an intern. Well, what does that mean for younger workers? Does it mean more pressure that you have to skip over the basics and master the hard tasks right away? Or does it mean less time spent on low-level stuff and more time for more important work? In a moment, you'll hear from someone whose job was taken over by AI, so she pivoted. But first, Professor Aaron Quigley is from Data61, the CSIRO's data and digital research arm. Aaron, what was your very first professional job?
I'd worked in my father's shop in Ireland for a number of years, but I think my first professional role was when I became a teacher of English in Japan. And then I was using digital tools to help me create some of the content that I was using with the students. So I've always been using digital tools throughout my entire career.
You've been putting your money where your mouth is since the beginning. That's good to hear. So with this concern that AI will kill internships and grad roles, is it a fear that's rooted in reality?
At the moment, yeah, we are seeing that there's announcements of reductions in the number of internship opportunities. But I think that's just a cause of industry and businesses thinking about what does it actually mean to have an intern and what does it actually mean to bring in the next generation of workforce. So I think we'll see more roles actually coming up in the future, because to drive these AI systems to actually interact with them and use them, in many cases, it's actually the younger workers who are more adept and are more willing to give it a go and learn and see what's the potential of these tools. So I think maybe at the moment we'll see kind of a bit of a dip, but the entry workforce will start to uptick, because people will need more and more people who are knowledgeable and willing and able to interact and use and drive these very sophisticated AI systems.
That is a more optimistic perspective than I think I expected. It's a different skill set though, isn't it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. But I think back to like every job that I've ever gone into, and then every time I've brought in a new set of interns. Like recently I had an intern that came in from a high school here in on the outskirts of Sydney, and I asked him to work for a week using AI tools. I brought him to some of the talks that were going on at the AI Institute in UNSW. I got him to meet with some of the scholars that we know and who we work with. He met with Martin Green and everything. So what we expect of younger people can be just reflective of the knowledge and skills and capabilities they actually have. So I expect more of interns, because I know that they have access to more sophisticated tools and they're using them in their education as well. But I think that's a great opportunity to bring in a more upskilled workforce and actually encouraging them to do more high value work early on, rather than just doing these kind of things that we wish we didn't have to do when we started out.
Yeah, that kind of busy work that you kind of give to junior employees sometimes. Well, it's funny that you sort of talk about this pivot towards developing AI skills, because Leanne Shelton's with me. She worked as a copywriter and then clients started using AI to do what she used to do for them. So she's pivoted. Leanne, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you. Good to be here, Tegan.
When did you realise there was a problem for you with AI?
It started happening around early 2023. Conversions had started dropping and I started having clients say, oh, don't worry about it, I'll just get ChatGPT to do it. And, you know, I had a copywriting agency and I'm like, we're paid to write website content and articles, and suddenly there's this free shiny tool that's just crash-landed in my space. How do I compete with that? And I basically just thought, okay, I could take this time to freak out, but that's not really going to serve me. Or maybe I could use my experience somewhere and go with it.
So what did you end up doing?
So I basically realized that, you know, ChatGPT is all about words and I'm a word person, and too many people were focusing on the prompts, like the initial input, and not enough people were talking about the output, like what do you actually do with the content that AI generates? And so I thought, okay, I'm a copywriter, I've got marketing experience, I know how to make it higher quality. And I put on a webinar, how to use ChatGPT and still sound human, because that just seemed to be a pain point for a lot of people, how robotic chaotic it sounded. And I kind of taught myself over a month of how you can actually train this tool to work with you and then pump out quality content. And so that's how it kind of started, but it's kind of evolved a bit from there.
You're listening to Life Matters here on Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Leanne Shelton, who was a copywriter, still is kind of, but now harnessing the power of AI to still kind of retain value in the market, and Professor Aaron Quigley from CSIRO's Data 61. So, Aaron, listening to Leanne, she could adapt. Some people can't. Like, what do you do if you're in one of these roles that doesn't seem to be adaptable, or are you just not being creative enough?
I think reach out to other people who actually have these experiences like Leanne did. We're not alone anymore. There's huge numbers of networks actually available. There's all kinds of training courses online. There's ways to actually find other people. So finding mentors, I think, is going to be very important in the future. And not just a single mentor, but actually having like some domain-specific and some career-specific mentors across two or three different areas, and then getting advice from them and getting introductions to people who are a little bit further advanced in their career than you. It's very heartening to hear what Leanne did, like taking the tools, learning, embracing them, and actually adding value beyond. Because I do really feel that we're talking about using a new tool, that we should be embracing this. Lots of tools have come along and people are worried that it'll displace jobs, but what it ends up doing is creating new jobs, creating new opportunities, because we just expand human knowledge, we expand the capabilities of individuals, and it opens up and kind of democratizes a lot of these tools.
Leanne, I can hear you going yes in the background there. What do you sort of hope people understand about this landscape?
Yeah, so definitely expand on that. I really believe in using AI to amplify your experience and expertise, just like what I've done. There's so many other roles that, things like we still have bank tellers, even though I've had online banking. We still have QuickBooks and Xero, even though, we have accountants and bookkeepers, even though we have those software, and graphic designers, even though we have Canva. And so the thing is that we need to realize that there's still always going to be a place for humans. What are my concern is where people get lazy with AI and go, oh, look, just ask ChatGPT, get them to do this for you. And what I call it is like, it's a bit of a productivity trap. Like, you get caught up in how good it is in the moment, how much time it's saving you, but not thinking about how it lands. And so what it needs to come back to is this remembering, all right, where can actually enhance me and what I know, not replace my knowledge. And I don't want people who know nothing about a topic and just getting AI do it for them. We need to be using it. So the junior workers, you know what you know is fresh out of university, and you know how to use tools like you're born with a phone in your hand. They're more likely to embrace and think differently to, older people as well. So there's definitely opportunities for everyone. It's just like embracing that and just remembering that the humans must always stay in control. Like, I really believe in a human first approach and not, the tools taking over. The tools take over.
There's a wonderful text on the text line from Mark. Mark says, using AI for introductory and junior work is inappropriate. I've seen a similar thing in the trades and manual work. It pays off in the skills and competence to use hand tools first, then the power tools. They're more effective if they have competence with the hand tools. Likewise, the computer assist. There are also reports that the human programmers are now doing even more. The AI-generated code needs review, and that takes more than doing from scratch. Aaron, what's sort of your parting words to people who are kind of going, how do I navigate this landscape? How do I develop the right skills or help the junior people in my life develop these skills?
I would definitely echo what we just heard, that it's the human voice that we want to accentuate and amplify. And we want to make sure that whatever we're doing is going to be very authentic. The worst thing you can actually see is when somebody is using a system and they're literally just passing it through. They don't actually have the capabilities to actually understand that it's an augmentation. It's an expression of them that they're basically putting forth into the world. So if it's not authentic, and if it's not actually amplifying the human voice, then I think that's a risk for all of us. And the way to do that is to encourage younger people to actually develop their own voice, and then to use AI to just amplify that, so that they actually have the capabilities to look at what is being produced. All those software engineers you're talking about, those hardware engineers, all those developers, all those designers, all those content producers, producers, they need to look at what's produced and use deep human intelligence and deep expertise to actually know that this is actually amplifying their voice and isn't just some hallucination or some fantasy that's actually being produced. So there's still a huge amount of human knowledge that actually is needed to guide what the AI can actually do for us.
Aaron, thank you so much. Aaron Quigley is from Data 61, the CSIRO's data and digital research arm. And thank you, Leanne Shelton, founder of Human Edge. In our regular segment, My Two Cents, we ask those questions you'd rather not answer about money, but that you really want to know about other people's money. You've heard from comedians, scientists, and musicians on how they manage their money so far. Last time you heard how music sent the Super Jesus' Sarah McLeod bankrupt, and of course, how she pulled herself out of it. Today, he's dedicated his career to understanding how money works and how to deal with the housing crisis. So you might be shocked to hear how ABC finance guru Alan Kohler paid the deposit for his first house.
Hello, I'm Alan Kohler, and I make money in two ways. I work for the ABC as a finance presenter on the news and a columnist for the website, and I also work for a company called InvestSmart, which owns a newsletter called Intelligent Investor. My last three purchases were a Doona jacket. I call it a Doona jacket because it's a winter coat. That tells you that I do what my wife tells me to do, because she wanted me to buy that to keep myself warm. I also bought sheets for a grandchild, which is her birthday, and that tells you that my grandchildren are very important to me. And I also bought a half a dozen tins of coffee, and that's also really important to me. My first pay was when I was a paper boy, when I was 15. And I was delivering newspapers in the morning, and I spent my first pay on cigarettes, which is not a great thing to do when you're 15, and I shouldn't have been the smoker, but I was. I smoked. My father was a builder, but unfortunately he wasn't a very good builder, so he went bust a couple of times. And so money was talked about both as something that was elusive and not important. I guess the other thing that was true of my father particularly, but also, you know, my mother, was that they didn't care much about money. And so in a way I was brought up to think that money wasn't a big deal. And that's how I kind of started life, really. Look, the biggest thing I've had to unlearn about money is that it's not important. I have learned that money is important. It's not the most important thing. It's possibly not even the second most important thing, but it is important, and the less you have, the more important it becomes. I first met my wife in 1978. I was 23, she was 20, and she turned 21, and I bought her a little... I barely knew her, we just met, but I bought her a little blue perfume bottle that was really cheap. It wasn't much, but she loved it. And we've been together ever since. So I'd have to say that little perfume bottle brought me the greatest joy. The purchase I most regret would have to be a motorcycle I bought in Tennant Creek in Northern Territory, which I owned for about a month, and came off it at Katherine on my way to Darwin. By driving into a ditch, and was knocked out and almost killed. And woke up in the back of someone's car on the way to a hospital. So yeah, it wasn't a great purchase. I mean, I didn't know how to ride. This is the trouble. They gave me the motorcycle license in Tennant Creek without testing me, and I hadn't actually ridden a motorbike when I got the license. And they just gave it to me over the counter, and off I went and started riding the thing, and I wasn't very good at it. So that wasn't great. I think the biggest decision I had to make about money was starting my own business. 2016, I decided to start my own newsletter business, and it didn't work. And I knew it was a big decision. And it ended up costing me $700,000, which was just gone money. It was costly, and, you know, we were okay. I just ended up, had to get a job. I mean, we sort of came out of it okay in the end, but it was a big decision. Look, I'm not proud of this, but my deposit for the first house was on the bank card, on the credit card. I did take out, that was the credit card loan for the deposit, and then I borrowed the money, the rest of the money. So I didn't have a cent, basically. Don't do this, folks out there. This is not recommended. I mean, apart from anything else, in those days, houses were fairly cheap. You know, like the house cost $20,000, I think, or less, maybe an $18,000. I mean, we're talking about the loan on the credit card was $1,000. That was the deposit. So, you know, these days, the median house price is $800,000. You need, you know, you're going to need $200,000 or $150,000 for that. You can't put that on a credit card. If I won the lottery, I'd set up a education fund for my six grandchildren. No more motorbikes. Definitely no more motorbikes. Look, if there was still some money left over after the education fund for the grandchildren, I'd probably get myself a Bentley. I love cars. I like good cars. So I'd probably get a Bentley or maybe something else. I don't know. Bloke over the road's got an Aston Martin. That looks pretty good. I'm Alan Kohler, and that's my 2 cents.
Finance experts, they're just like us. That's ABC finance journalist Alan Kohler on my 2 cents here on Radio National Life Matters. Well, stick with me because up next, the huge generational divide in the workplace separating Gen Zs and baby boomers. There's a generational divide in Australian workplaces. It's unfolding between Gen Zs and boomers. And it's actually not over technology or that eternal question whether this meeting could have been an email. You might have seen it on social media. There's a video trend called the Gen Z stare. Older people say they make a comment or a request to someone under 25 years old and they're just met with a blank look. So is this even a thing, or is it just being confected in the intergenerational culture war? Our resident sociologist Dan Woodman is here to unpack this. Dan, you teach young people as a university lecturer. Are you copying this stare a lot?
Look, yeah, I've been teaching undergraduate students at universities for about 20 years now, and I will say that I've definitely had some blank stares come back at me. But I'm not sure it's become markedly worse in the last few years, although there are some colleagues and a few hints that maybe people's communication skills have been shifting a little bit over time and across the generations.
Do you sort of have a definition for the Gen Z stare? I'm detecting a note of cynicism in your voice about this.
And I'm giving that cynicism with a Gen Z stare on my face. So the idea is basically almost like a moment of more of a brain shutting down for a moment than an actual disdain in the look. So it's got a mix of a kind of sense of people stopping for a moment and looking at you because you've asked something that's not reasonable and a little bit of eye rolling, but also this sense of just a kind of deer in the headlights for a second from maybe younger people working in retail or hospitality who don't know how to respond if they've been asked something that feels like it's not right or out of the ordinary.
Is it something unique to Gen Z as a generation, or is this just like being 20, like just that kind of feeling of being like, oh my gosh, I don't know how to be a grown up right now.
Yes, and also this sense that maybe young people are working out how to be a grown up, but also that the grown ups are complaining about the young people, which is also not new. You know, there's some classic things you can Google about Aristotle complaining about the young people these days in ancient Greece, and this idea of people not following the rules of polite interaction with their elders has a very long history. And it's worth noting that this discussion of the Gen Z stare has been a TikTok meme, a social media thing. It's not something that's been released from a rigorous study of the changes in young people's styles of interaction.
You're listening to Life Matters here on Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to our resident sociologist, Dan Woodman, this week about the Gen Z stare. If this is something that you have experienced and you want emotional support... or have theories about where it's come from. Dan, this is a generation that has grown up with cameras around them constantly. Is there something about my interpretation when I sometimes see this Gen Z stare is when someone whips a phone out to take a photo, and it's sort of like a decline to participate in being the fake cheeriness sort of thing.
Yes, I think there's maybe a couple of different things going on. So I was saying that this idea of the Gen Z stare isn't really backed up by a lot of research, but there is some research that does say maybe as young people, but particularly the group who had some formative years during COVID lockdowns, but even more so the broader group who have just grown up online and with social media and with other communication platforms, is that social skills and communication skills, we're not born with them. They do take some time and practice to develop, and the Gen Zs might have spent more time learning or practicing communication in different forms, not in that kind of face-to-face interaction with strangers. So that's one side of it. The other thing is that younger cohorts always want to play around and almost communicate differently to the generation before. So if certain things are expected by 40-somethings, sometimes 20-somethings are gonna say, no, I don't accept that is a reasonable thing to do. In some ways, it's related to the way that each new generation will come up with some different slang. So, you know, my generation might say, well done, Tegan, Life Matters. It's an ace show, but any Gen Zs out there listening might say it slaps or something like that. You know, the way we communicate and the way we almost communicate so that others can't understand us does have this pattern of shifting with a new generation.
So without sounding, excuse me, the most patronising thing I've ever said, is this something that they're going to grow out of? Like, or is this something that we're all going to grow into? Like a few years ago when everyone was saying fleek and then you're sort of like, oh, I'm never going to say that, that's stupid, and then you end up saying it ironically and then all of a sudden you're saying it unironically and then it's not cool anymore.
Like, yeah.
Are we going to all end up staring at each other or are the Gen Zs going to stop staring?
Well, that's it. I was thinking, as I said, that the Gen Zs would say that Life Matters slaps, and that's a good thing for everyone listening out there, that as soon as I said that they must not be saying that anymore or it's no longer cool to say that.
The minute it came out of your mouth, they deleted it from the vocab.
Exactly. But it's really hard to tell because there's two kind of different effects that social scientists would talk about. One is a kind of cohort or generational effect where we do create different ways of interacting. Acting that we take with us across our life course. The other thing is period effects, that we live in particular times and adjust to them. So young people will change as they get older in the way they communicate, but all of us are now living in this environment where maybe the phone call starts to become something that's almost rude and the text message or even the emoji message becomes the way to go. And that is going to probably shift the way we think about what's appropriate in our everyday communicative interactions.
I know that there's research that showed that young women are the ones that really shape language development in terms of like the study of linguistics. It's really interesting to be broadening that out, to be looking at gestures and even emojis.
That's right. And I think that's often been the case, that young women particularly play around with language the most. And I think there's just been an explosion of opportunities to play around with the language. Like there's verbal communication, but there's also emojis and memes that mean different things to different groups. I think that there's some things to be worried about in terms of communication skills. But also, I think there's a much richer set of ways to communicate that young people are using now compared to when I was in high school and we used to just quote the same inane 10 lines from the latest comedy movie at each other all day.
Dan, because I'm old and boring, I am smiling instead of staring at you. Thank you so much, as always, for joining me.
Thanks, Tegan.
Dan Woodman is our resident sociologist, and although not a Gen Z, he is an occasional Gen Z starer. Well, that is it for Life Matters today on ABC Radio National. Tomorrow we are talking books, how they change us, shape us, and sometimes set our lives on new paths. You can catch up on any of our stories on the ABC Listen app, and I'll catch you again tomorrow.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.